Once again, it is my privilege to be joined by Donald Freed, along with Raymond Briggs, the co-author of Killing Time, published in hardcover by Macmillan, copyright 1996. Stephen Singular, the author of Legacy of Deception, softcover Dove, 1995. And Stephen Wirth, along with Carl Jaspers, the co-author of Blood Oath, The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson, softcover Rainbow, 1996. Gentlemen, once again, let's proceed. Let's proceed with our analysis. Stephen Wirth, one of the things that you brought up in our past discussions concerns a comparison between the Manson killings and the scenario presented by your anonymous informant, Skinner. Could you perhaps briefly develop that again for us?
Sure. And it's one of the things that surprised me about Vincent Bugliosi, about his book Outrage, where he never takes into account his famous Helter Skelter. Helter Skelter was basically about Manson, who set out to start a race war. Mm. He picked prominent white people to savagely brutalize them, which is what he did with the Tates and LaBiancas, with the idea of blaming it on the Black Panthers.
Right.
And as such, would walk away. And Bugliosi, in his own words, when he was going to court to try it, the judge did not believe. Said, you better come up with a better motive than just someone's trying to start a race war. But that was the only motive that was there. What's even more interesting in that book is that he had his own little, if someone wanted to follow Helter Skelter and do do these crimes, all he had to do was follow this time that was laid out by Bugliosi, because and some of the incidents. What you had was Manson training his people how to cut the throats of people by grabbing the hair, and he demonstrated on one of his young girls, grabbing the hair and slitting the throat. That was one of the things. And he had this kind of killing thing. But what's even more interesting, and you talk about deja vu, you had two people who were involved in the Manson murder and in the Cole Brown Simpson murder.
You mean
Vanetta?
The investigations.
That's right.
Yeah.
Vanetta was an investigator.
Really?
On the earlier case, and one of the first police officers. I think his name was William Richard Wally, was one of the first officers on the scene. But not only, and also on both scenes. He was the first officer on the scene at the Manson murders and one of the first officers at the scene of the Bundy King. But what's even more interesting is he claims in a news article, this is Wally, that he took the kids out the back and took them down to the police station. That's not what was testified to in this case. And I wonder why. Now, I had sent this information off to the Bakers.
Mm.
You know, a copy of this, with some, questions to see whether they could follow up on that.
Mm.
Because, I mean, here's a this officer who claims one thing, and yet in the case they claim something else. But all of this certainly followed very closely what occurred in the book Helter Skelter.
A couple of points very quickly, Stephen Wirth, and then we'll move on to some other aspects of the case. A colleague of mine, the late Mae Brussel, who worked with Donald Freed for this in the Citizens Research and Investigating Committee, believed that the Manson operation was also, in all probability, in fact, she didn't believe in all probability, she believed it was a domestic intelligence operation, and basically a number of different things were accomplished. We should note that the Manson family has gone down in history as, a bunch of wayward hippies. The inner core of that group, and certainly there were some people who were from that persuasion, I guess you could say, the inner core, many of them were members of the Aryan Brotherhood, a very powerful Nazi prison gang linked with some of the same white supremacist elements that your informant, linked institutionally and ideologically, some of the informants that... some of the people that your informant talked about. One of the people who was disseminating disinformation for whatever reason about the Manson killings, and again, it was basically intended to start a race war, was a fellow named Ed Butler. Now, Donald, in your in your discussions of your investigations into the Kennedy assassination, Ed Butler is somebody that any serious researcher has to know. Could you maybe tell us a little more about Ed Butler?
Yes, indeed. And then I'd like to ask you a little bit more about his role in the Manson affair, which I did not know about.
Sure.
Ed Butler worked for a group called Inca in New Orleans, and Inca went to great lengths in raising funds and creating propaganda and working very closely with the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean. And this was the umbrella group which ran the anti-Castro hit teams that were training in Lake Pontchartrain. And Butler was involved in the building of a jacket or a profile of Lee Harvey Oswald so that literally on the day of the assassination of President Kennedy, Butler was on the air and the tapes were going national with Lee Harvey Oswald talking about his defection to the Soviet Union in the 1950s. And this became, this was clearly going to be the radio verbal portrait, which was matched by Lee Harvey Oswald with a gun in one hand and two so-called revolutionary newspapers in the other. Parenthetically, that photograph, you may remember, was enhanced, so-called, by Life magazine. The picture of the gun was doctored. They were caught. They had to apologize for doing it, just as Time magazine was caught blackening O.J. Simpson's visage on its cover in June of 1994. But Ed Butler then moved to Southern California, working with Patrick Frawley and other extremists behind Ronald Reagan, and conducted what's called conflict management, but which in reality is the agent provocateur attempting to cause disorder and confusion, just as he had in New Orleans, and just as he had working with Alton Oxner and very wealthy right-wing ultras there, and then Frawley here, a kind of off-the-shelf, to use that term, provocation or black activities of a clandestine nature, to use the word black, meaning simply as a term of art from the intelligence world. And so Butler then left Los Angeles and continued somewhere in the hinterlands. But I did not know that he had spoken on the Manson case.
Yeah, Butler apparently also had returned to New Orleans as an author named Ed Haslam, who wrote a book called Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus.
Yes.
Who came across Ed Butler in New Orleans back in the 1980s.
Uh-huh.
Now, by the way, we should also note for historical purposes that Ed Butler claimed to have been in contact with the CIA, although they denied it. We should also note for legal purposes that he's never been convicted or, as far as I know, accused of any crime, simply for legal purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back to Ed Butler and William Frawley. What Mae Russell came across, again, a very dear late friend and colleague, she came across a Frawley publication called, it was called Aware, the Square newspaper.
Yes.
And in it, there was an article by Ed Butler shortly after the Tate-LaBianca killings occurred, saying that he had a lot of experience with the counterinsurgency, and he knew Lee Harvey Oswald and Saran and so forth. And this was clearly, meaning the Tate-LaBianca killings, this was clearly the work of black militants, probably the Black Panthers.
Is that right?
Which is exactly what the Manson group wanted people to believe. And there's been another, and Ed Butler, too, by the way, showed up at a press conference that occurred the day after Robert Kennedy was assassinated, that was held by Anthony Hilder and John Steinbacher, a couple of L.A. area right-wingers, who shared a mailing address with their American United organization, shared a mailing address with the Edgar Eugene Bradley Defense Fund.
Mm.
Of course, he was one of the people Garrison tried to extradite to New Orleans. Now, very quickly, and Ed Butler was at this press conference, curiously, the day after Robert Kennedy was killed.
Mm.
There's a recent book called Orders to Kill by William Pepper, who wrote the introduction to
Yes.
Your Marvelous Death in Washington.
Yes.
The book Orders to Kill discusses, it's about the assassination of Martin Luther King, and it talks about a couple of a Green Beret Alpha team.
Yes.
Recruited from the 20th Special Forces Group being in New Orleans to back up the organized crime sniper who actually did the killing. One of the things discussed by some of the veterans who spoke under condition of anonymity, the living ones, was that the 20th Special Forces Group, which, by the way, had given military training to Ku Klux Klansmen in Alabama in exchange for field-level intelligence about local black activists, members of this group had been employed by the federal government to spy on black activists and political activists all over the country, including L.A.
Yes.
And one of the most interesting things that is discussed by one of these members is that they were asked to basically engage in a spec wet ops determined with regard to a house which is described as being in the hills of West Los Angeles near UCLA that Robert Kennedy was known to stay at during his trips to Los Angeles. Now, a spec wet ops determined means basically to find out if a spec wet op, could be performed. That's an operation in which a team goes into a house, kills everybody in the house, and then leaves without detection. Now, as far as I know, I know that Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski had been deeply involved with Robert Kennedy's campaign in the L.A. area. And they also, the night before Robert Kennedy was assassinated, he disclosed at a dinner with them, among others, that he was going to reopen the investigation into his brother's murder after he was elected. Now, what I'm wondering is, I have not been able to determine, and Donald, I'll rely on your expertise here, of any other house in that area, and that is the area of the Cielo Drive house, is it not?
Yes, and let me interject something, David, and ask the others permission, because we are free associating at the moment, but there's nothing...
Right.
But there's nothing wrong in that, because we're going to be able to abstract some of the elements of this zeitgeist, of this propaganda that's going on. So we needn't shrink from this. But I happened to see on the History Channel, and I came in late, and I wonder if anyone else saw it, a really remarkable discussion going on by former Green Berets who had been part of an assassination team and who had conducted killings in this country, and they had the documents on television. It was called the Freedom Force, and it was a riveting and totally credible discussion. Now, I did not hear the first part, but the man who was basically on camera and who broke down at the end, and now an elderly man, but there were his pictures with his medals in his youth at Fort Bragg, and he had refused an assignment to kill a high-ranking naval officer. And the assignment had been that he had to be killed before his retirement in 1965, and he said he would not kill anyone in this country. That was not his understanding of his training. And then a colleague of his was approached. Well, then the newspaper columns and clippings were shown on television, and this naval officer, who was murdered just before his retirement, was the man who had been in charge of the autopsy in Washington, D.C., of John F. Kennedy, had been in charge of all the files and had stated that after his retirement, he intended to go public with information from the autopsy.
And this was Lieutenant Commander Bruce Pitzer, who later turned up a suicide. Naval intelligence officers, according to Pitzer's widow, had intimidated her into silence. I'm really glad that you free associated on this, Donald, because the name of that Green Beret officer was Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin.
That's right.
And he was a captain at the time. And the week before our last interview on these airwaves, I interviewed Dan Marvin.
Is that right?
About that. And then later, when he was stationed in Vietnam, he was requisitioned by the CIA. He refused that assignment and later almost threw up when he saw that Pitzer had been, or Pitzer, I've forgotten which, had been killed. He then later was requisitioned to kill Prince Sihanouk in Cambodia.
Is that right?
In order to blame it on the communists and to basically instigate the Cambodian army into attacking the North Vietnamese and denying them the sanctuaries. He refused to, he initially agreed to do the assignment, but was told that on the condition that LBJ would formally acknowledge the Cambodian sanctuaries. He was basically told, what are you kidding? You're going to give us orders? Forget it. He refused to do it, at which point, according to Colonel Marvin, an elite Arvin regiment, Army, South Vietnamese Army regiment, was requisitioned to wipe out him, his entire A-team, and the 500 or so Wahao mercenaries, the militant Buddhist sect that they were training, who were going to be involved in the cross-border assassination attempt against Sihanouk. This was blocked at the last moment, according to Colonel Marvin. So that is a fortuitous addition by you. Going back, though, to what admittedly, now we're talking about some coincidental facts which may or may not be directly connected.
Well, we're talking about a subculture which, under the name of anti-communism during the Cold War, seems to have been an umbrella for a secret and criminal series of overlapping official and semi-official and unofficial organizations which have just about taken the country to the brink.
Now, going back again, we should bear in mind that in our earlier discussion, another hour segment, we talked about the criminal conspiracy section,
yes,
its links with the intelligence community, and the fact that a veteran of that LAPD intelligence unit had been in charge of the crime scene at Bundy, the former Connie Milazzo, whatever that might mean, and that she had worked for a newspaper in Italy that had received funding from the CIA. Perhaps there's no significance to that. On the other hand, perhaps there's a great deal.
Well, you're right. If there were a true investigation here, we would want to know whether Mark Furman, what his role might have been in the proven and exposed LAPD so-called computerized bootlegging of what they called subversives and the peddling of that information to ultra groups across the country. That's the LAPD we're talking about.
And bearing in mind, again, what this veteran of the 20th Special Forces Group, who were involved with spying on black militants in the area. By the way, interesting enough, Donald, Lewis Tackwood, who was your informant for the CRIC work on the Glass House tapes, alleges that Ron Karenga, a local black activist, had been utilized in the war against the Black Panthers.
Well, that is right. In the Geronimo Pratt case, which, of course, exercises many, and especially in Northern California, there we have links again that have come forth from Wes Swearingen, an FBI special agent who has gone public, and he also has gone public about the same Connie Milazzo, John Dial, and others in the LAPD. So to those who, for whom it may sound as if this free association is a kind of a nightmare, a farrago of names and places, what we're doing is giving a kind of ventilation to a subculture and a climate which, under the heading of anti-communism and now crime and law and order, begins to poison a whole culture.
Just interest.
One second, Stephen Worth. I just wanted to underscore one point. I realize that I've been monopolizing the podium here. I'm going to give the two Stevens and Donald Fried a chance to hold forth at considerable length here in just a minute. But going back to some of the connections that I've been, or some of the points of information I've been making, one of the points that is in Orders to Kill, this veteran of the 20th Special Forces Group, which we should recall had been giving military training to Ku Klux Klan elements in Alabama, he claims that they were going to kill Ron Karenga, but that Karenga, for some reason, didn't show up at the last minute. One wonders, and this is obviously speculation, perhaps he was tipped off because of his alleged role with some of the same elements. But going again back to, because this all relates to the Manson situation, Stephen Worth, members of the 20th Special Forces Group have stated that they were to reconnoiter a house in West Los Angeles, in the hills near UCLA, which had been used by Robert Kennedy when he came to stay in the Los Angeles area for spec wet ops determined. In other words, to determine how feasible it would be to insert a team, kill everybody in the house, and then get out without detection. And I believe, I have been asking around, the only house that fits that description, from what I have been able to gather, and perhaps there's other information that I'm not aware of, was the Cielo Drive house, in which, about a year later, all of the occupants were killed, and the assassins escaped without detection, including Sharon Tate, who'd been very much involved with Robert Kennedy's campaign in the L.A. area. Of course, Robert Kennedy himself was assassinated, bearing in mind also the Ed Butler role in, for whatever reason and whatever motivation, in endorsing in the media, in the Frawley publication, the very cover story that the Manson group had been looking to perpetrate, namely to blame the killings on black militants and start a race war. I realize that this is entirely speculative, but one wonders whether perhaps... by the way, we should also bear in mind Vincent Bugliosi, who has been very active in condemning O.J. Simpson. Vincent Bugliosi was also the Legal Eagle, who in a mock trial of Lee Harvey Oswald, he was the prosecutor, and he maintains that Lee Harvey Oswald did the killing of President Kennedy all by himself, which raises more questions than it answers, I think, in my mind. But it, certainly I think that it could be said at the very least that Vincent Bugliosi needs to restudy the John F. Kennedy case. But one wonders. Again, I wonder about the possibility of the O.J. Simpson case as a possible domestic intelligence operation. And people with intelligence and covert operations background were utilized in the strike team, according to your informant, Skinner. And I wonder whether your speculation, Stephen Wirth, about the Manson situation, as analogous to what your informant told you about the O.J. Simpson case, might, in fact, be even more precise than what we might have suspected. I wonder if Mabe Russell's speculation about the Manson case as a domestic intelligence operation, in light of the things that I've mentioned, was correct. And I have the same question about the O.J. Simpson case.
Now, yeah, there's an interesting person that not many people have talked about. It's a fellow by the name of Scott T. Barnes. Scott T. Barnes, somehow, and by the way, he was the same fellow that was picked up in Perot's office for attempting to wiretap is in 92, supposedly has been claimed to be linked with the CIA. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, he got himself involved with the O.J. Simpson case. He met with McKenna, the investigator for the defense. He met with Pavlik, the investigator for defense. He met with the Special Investigation Unit of Judge Ito. And then on June 23rd, filed a suit against Judge Ito in Bakersfield, claiming that Judge Ito had requested that he wiretap the jury. Now, he withdrew that suit on July. What's interesting, but I think July 5th, I spoke to him. I asked him why, you know, how he got involved. He really didn't have any answer. I verified that he had met with all of the investigators. I verified with they had met with the Special Investigative Unit. He had to go to the district attorney in order to do that. This person was the same person that supposedly was part of an assassination group in the southeast during, and was also trying to bring back the POWs. Mm-hmm. Same Scott Barnes.
Right.
Was involved in Honolulu in a CIA attempt.
We should say that what Scott Barnes claims was that he was requisitioned to kill Ron Riewald.
That's correct.
We should also once again state for legal purposes that as far as I know, Scott Barnes has not been charged with or convicted of any crimes in connection with this case.
That's correct.
Okay.
No, he's not at all.
Go ahead.
But what occurred was I said, well, why did you drop this suit? Now, the suit is interesting when he filed it. Filed it about 5 days after the glove didn't fit, which was almost a sure thing that the defense had the case at that point.
Yeah.
He filed, and I asked him, why did he file the action? He said, well, I believe at that point O.J. Simpson was guilty because of Rosie Greer, the supposedly instant saying that I did it in prison, that it was claimed that the one of the guards overheard it. I said, but yeah, but that was November of 94. And then he said, well, I don't want to talk any further. And what bothered me about it is, in order for me to get to talk to Scott Barnes, I had to call a radio station, KDNO, and they patched me through to Scott Barnes, who then later called me from a payphone and told me he had just been taking some anti-terrorist training in Georgia, et cetera. But he had been convicted of wiretapping in Delano, California. And yet he was able to go to Texas at the time to get involved with Perot. He was able to walk into this case like nobody knew anything. It took me 10 minutes to find everything out about him. And yet he was able to go into this case and get himself intertwined between the prosecution and the defense, and then file a suit and walk away with nobody hearing about it.
Oh, by the way, we should also mention Scott Barnes is a former Green Beret, and Ron Riewald, who I alluded to earlier, was the Riewald in Bishop Baldwin, Riewald, Dillingham, and Wong, an alleged CIA front in Hawaii. Riewoldt claims he was working for the CIA and worked doing all sorts of illegal things for the CIA. The CIA, of course, has denied it, and he went down as the lone nut with no connection.
Yeah, he also wrote a book called Bohica, which I obtained the copy from his attorney, which he appeared before the Congress to give testimony, about, and he had a whole book. He claimed he was involved with the CIA and had some documents in there that seemed to substantiate it. Yet the CIA denied they even knew him.
Yep, and we should bear that in mind.
A year or so ago, when I was talking to CBS News, I was trying to get them interested in some of the information I had, and was totally unsuccessful at it, but I was talking to a woman who, actually, she's married to one of the reporters of at the Times who was covering the trial, Henry Weinstein. Her name is Lori Becklin, and she kept asking me about Scott Barnes.
Mm.
And I didn't know anything about him. I mean, this is all relatively new to me, other than his name. So he had surfaced in their quarters, too, but I never quite understood his significance.
Mm-hmm. Stephen?
We'll be continuing with this discussion in the next half-hour segment. We are speaking with Stephen Singular, the author of Legacy of Deception, softcover Dove, copyright 1995. Stephen Wirth, along with Carl Jaspers, the author of Blood Oath, The Conspiracy to Kill Nicole Brown Simpson, softcover Rainbow Books, 1996. And Donald Freed, along with Raymond Briggs, the co-author of Killing Time, about the O.J. Simpson case, published in hardcover by Macmillan, copyright 1996. We're going to be continuing with this discussion in the next half-hour segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.